The buildings around us bulged and warped, and deep bass note sounds began to drop down below the range of human hearing all around us. "Soon it'd be better than later," the old wizard said. "Right," I said, and forced my weary body to start moving. "Come on." Chapter 12. We ran, and the corner hounds followed us. I wasn't sure how many of them had taken up our trail. It was more than half a dozen, but fewer than 20. They made oddly light-sounding skittering noises and created small clouds of sparks when they moved on concrete, the result of those steel-hard claws striking the ground. They clung to the sides of buildings like giant spiders, those same talons biting into brick and concrete, easily supporting their weight. I took us down the alley in the direction opposite the one where I'd tossed the first corner hound, across the street, slight jog, and then down the alley beyond. "They aren't following real close," I noted. All the cardio lately was standing me in good stead now. My heart was working, and I was breathing hard, and I barely noticed. "They know we're dangerous," the old man panted. "They aren't used to dealing with our reality, or with beings that can actually hurt them, makes them hesitate." "Here," I said, and turned into the opening of a parking garage, weaving around the wooden arm that would swing up to allow cars in. I slowed down enough to let the old man catch up to me. He wasn't covering the ground as easy as I was. Behind us, the corner hounds didn't lope so much as scuttle, as if they had to stop to consider each burst of motion before committing to it. They were deathly swift when they moved, absolutely oily with speed, and when they stopped, they were statues still, except for the quivering of the little tentacles running down their flanks. On any one of them, it might have looked a little silly. By the time you spread the sudden, darting motions out to a baker's dozen or so of them, it crossed the line to unnerving. There was something exceptionally primitive about the motion, something reptilian, even insectile about it. It would have been creepy if the hounds had been the size of beagles. When they were more the size of horses, it was downright terrifying. "Fire's best," the old man continued, grimly keeping pace with me. "Anything magic they can shrug off to one degree or another. All natural fire works just fine on them, though." "What's the difference where the fire came from?" I asked. "The difference is anything we just make out of our will, they can slip most of the punch," he said. "I ain't got time to give you a graduate seminar on intention versus the natural operation of the universe until you've completed my 'why it's a damn stupid thing to trust vampires' course." The parking garage was built under the apartment building above us, and the top level was mostly full. There wouldn't be room to do much fighting in there, which meant there was only one way to go, down. As a rule, when you're running from something, up or down tends to be a bad idea. The higher up or further down you go, the fewer and fewer ways there are out of a situation. And when something is chasing you, keeping your options open is another way of staying alive. I gave the old man a worried glance as I headed down. He looked around and came to the same conclusion I had. "No help for it, Hoss. Head down." "No need to drag the white cord into this," I said to him as I led the way down. "They aren't involved yet." "You're here in the first place because you think you're protecting the vampire's concubine," the old man groused. "And for all you know, they summoned these things and sent them after you." I glanced back as the first couple or three corner hounds slithered around the corner at the top of the ramp behind us and let out chest-shivering calls of discovery. Ahead of us, where walls and roof or floor formed a corner, sickly blue light began to glow. "Not Lara's style," I panted, leading us down another level. "She does the cloak and dagger stuff for politics, but for her personal enemies, she's reliable. If she wanted me dead, she'd come at me with a knife. She's straightforward that way." "Till the one time she isn't, and you're too dead to complain about how reliable vampires ain't," Ebenezer growled. We spilled out into the bottom level of the parking garage. It was mostly empty. We were near the limit of how low solid ground could go in this part of the city. The lowest depressions in the concrete were full of water that had the dank smell of long-standing sources of mold and mildew. We had to have been at the water level of the lake, or a little under. A place like this isn't going to react well to explosions and such, I noted, looking around. And it don't go quite low enough to get us enough water to get them immersed in it, he added. All right, boy, time to start teaching you the Starborn business. I blinked and almost tripped over my own feet. Wait, what? You're going to start talking about it now? He cuffed me on the shoulder irritably. We got maybe half a minute. Do you want to take a walk down memory lane? Freaking wizards, I complained, rubbing at my shoulder. Fine, tell me. Every couple of three wizard generations, Ebenezer said. The stars line up just right. What amounts to a spotlight plays over the earth for a few hours. Any child born within that light is starborn. I get it, I said. What does it mean? Power against the outsiders, the old man growled. Among other things, that their minds can't be magically tainted by contact with anything from outside, which means... My eyes widened. Hell's bells, I breathed. See, when it comes to entities from way outside everyday reality, there are only a few options for dealing with them. In the first place, they aren't really here in a strictly physical sense. They're coming in from outside of the mortal world, and that means constructing a body from ectoplasm and infusing it with enough energy and will to serve as a kind of avatar or drone for the supernatural being, still safely in its home reality. That's what the Corner Hounds had done when they'd come to Chicago to mess with us. Fighting something like that was often difficult. The bodies they inhabited tended to have no need for things like sensing pain, for example, and it took a considerable amount of extra energy to make a hit sink home. To fight them physically, you had to dismantle the machinery of the construct's body, breaking joints and bones until they just couldn't function anymore. For any creature of the physical size and resilience of these corner hounds, it was a far easier prospect to bind and banish them, to simply pit your will against their own and force them out of the bodies they inhabited when they came here. But that was sort of like rubbing your brain against a bus station toilet. You simply had no idea what you were going to pick up by doing it. And wizards, who frequently tangled with outsiders, or even the weirder entities from within our own reality, tended to go a little loopy due to the contamination of direct contact with alien, inhuman intelligences. That's why there was a whole law of magic about reaching beyond the outer gates. But if I was insulated against such influences, was that why Nemesis, for example, had revealed itself to me but had never actually attacked me in an effort to take control of my thoughts and actions? Because it actually couldn't? It made sense, grouped with my previous experience with outsiders, where others had been disabled by their attacks while I had still been capable of taking action. It meant that not only could I resist their influences, but I could go up against these things, mind to mind, without fear of short-circuiting my brain along the way. The old man meant for me to banish them, to trap them in a circle, and will them straight out of reality. How are we going to get them into a circle? I asked. Ebenezer leaned his staff against his body, produced a pocket knife from his overalls, and said, "Bait." He dug the knife into his arm and twisted, and a small rivulet of blood began to pour out of the wound and patter to the ground. The first of the corner hounds appeared at the top of the ramp behind us and let out a pitch-dropping moan, its tentacles quivering in time with the sound of falling droplets. It moved several feet toward us in an oily blur and then went still again, like some kind of bizarre deep-sea predator. "So, here's the exercise," Ebenezer said and passed me the knife. If he was in pain, it didn't show up in his voice. "Defensive circle first. We go at the same time. The smell of blood is going to drive them crazy, and they're going to try to get at me. While they do, you'll lay down a circle and activate it, then banish them." He eyed me. "And just so I'm certain you haven't missed the lesson, please also observe that every single point of the plan is vampire-free." The corners of the lowest level of the parking garage began to glow with a sickly blue light. "Sir," I growled, taking the knife. I bent over and walked around us in a quick circle, tip of the knife scoring the concrete as I went, until I had a closed shape that mostly looked like a circle. I stepped into it, touched the score mark, and made a minor effort of will, feeling the magical circle spring up around us like an invisible screen of energy. There's a time and a place for everything. This is neither. I offered him the knife back by the handle. The old man pumped his fist several times and made sure the blood kept dripping. Then he folded the pocket knife and put it away, taking up a staff and holding it upright and parallel to his spine with both hands, carefully keeping it inside the circle. Corner hounds began to thrash and tear their way into our world. Half a dozen more joined the one coming down the ramp in erratic bursts of speed, then simply crouched and waited. "You sure?" he asked. "How about we check with one of your stalwart vampire allies who are here in your hour of need?" I glowered at him. "That's a cheap shot, and you know it." 11, 12, the old man counted. 13. Aye. The whole pack is here. Now they'll get serious. "You think these things are smart?" I said. "Damn smart," he said. "But so single-minded and alien, you almost can't tell." "They'll try to stop me from laying down a circle, then," I said. "We need a smoke screen. But they don't even have eyes, do they? They don't have eyes at the back of their throats or something, do they?" "You don't want to know," said the old man. Suddenly, three of the corner hounds speed slithered close to us, tentacles flailing. One of them struck against the boundary described by the circle. There was a flash of light, a cascade of angry fireplace sparks, and a shuddering bass note of pain, and then the three corner hounds went still again. The one with a singed tentacle was no more than 2 feet away from me. I swallowed and did a quick scan of the circle with my eyes. A magical circle was proof against being summoned to the mortal world, outsiders included. But if any solid object fell across the scratch in the concrete, the circle would lose integrity and collapse, and we'd be at the thing's mercy. "But they run on audio?" I asked him. "Like bats." The corner hound near me rose onto its hind legs, tentacles probing, as if seeking a way around the curtain of force provided by the circle. There were sharp popping sounds as the tentacle tips brushed against the circle and recoiled in little bursts of sparks and low rumbles of pain. "No teeth," I noted, my throat dry. "Out of morbid curiosity, what happens to us if they, get us?" "They take us into one of those corners," Ebenezer said, "and drag us back to wherever they came from." I swallowed. "Then what?" The old man looked faintly disturbed and said something that, for wizards, is akin to dropping an F-bomb. "I don't know." I blinked at him and felt my eyes widening. "Oh." I swallowed again and said, "These are major entities. Don't know if I can take them all on at once." "There aren't multiple entities there," he said. "Just one that happens to be running around in several different bodies. It's a package deal, Hoss. You can't banish one of them without banishing all of them." I looked past Ebenezer to where an old pickup had been parked, the only car down on this lowest level. "And we have to turn up the pressure," I said, nodding at the old truck. "Ring a fire?" he asked. "Ring a fire," I said. "Damn, sure wish I had a bucket." The sneeze took me completely off guard. It came out of nowhere and was louder than it had any right to be, my voice cracking halfway through. There was a surge of tension and energy, a dizzying burst of involuntarily expended magical energy, and way too much ectoplasm coming out of my nose. There was also a clatter, and a galvanized 5-gallon steel bucket fell to the ground at my feet and started rolling. Ebenezer spat a curse and stabbed his staff at the bucket, pinning it to the ground an inch or two before it could break the circle and get us both killed. "Bucket," I finished lamely, my nasal passages completely obstructed by ectoplasm. "Ugh, sorry, it'll be gone in a second." The old man blinked at the bucket. "Hell's bells, boy. Conjuritis at your age?" "Conjure what now?" I asked. The old man lifted his right hand and murmured a word, fingers curling into a complex little sequence, and there was a surge of will from the old man that had enveloped the bucket. And instead of quivering and collapsing into ectoplasm, it held steady while the old man bent over and picked it up. Conjuritis. I told you about that. No, you haven't, sir, I said. The old man scowled at me. Are you sure? Maybe you just weren't listening, like on Vampire Day. Seriously, really? I demanded of him and swiped an arm at the tentacular horrors closing in on us. Right now? He thrust his jaw and the bucket at me. Every time you get tangled up with them, you get burned, he said. Boy, when are you going to use your head? I seized the bucket from him. Suddenly, without a word, without any kind of signal, all of the hounds crouched in an identical stance, and their tentacles began to vibrate all together. Go, Ebenezer thundered. Fast! Right, time to get my head in the game. Maybe the corner hounds couldn't physically get to us, but if all 13 of those things dropped the purely physical base on us all at once, I was pretty sure we weren't walking out of this garage. In a perfect world, I could have broken the circle, rendered myself undetectable to the enemy, and just slipped aside and let the old man keep their attention while I laid down the circle and came at them. But I'd have to make do with a birthday prank I'd been getting ready for Butters instead. First, step out of the circle. As I did, the corner hounds tensed, muscles and tendrils quivering. At the same time, Ebenezer began to backpedal to put his back to the nearest column supporting the garage, even as he brought up another bulwark of invisible force to take shelter behind. Come on, you great ugly beasties. The corner hounds' tentacle heads flared out, tracking the old man, and rumbling, vibrating, subsonic thunderclaps filled the air and made me dizzy. I rose, will gathered, and lifted my right hand, fingers spread to project energy, and snarled, Consulere Rex! The spell wasn't a terribly complicated one. It basically duplicated an air horn, just a little bigger, and it played a tune. Okay, look, you're gonna have to trust me on this one. Having a freaking Tyrannosaurus Rex roaring out the tune of Happy Birthday to You at full volume is an entirely appropriate birthday present for Waldo Butters. The sound that filled the parking garage wasn't the volume of an air horn, or a marching band, or a train's horn. It did, in fact, check in at around 160 decibels. It wasn't 165, because when I tried that much, it broke all the glasses in the kitchen and set my hair on fire. I'm not kidding. For the record, that's about the same amount of sound a passenger jet makes at takeoff. Now, imagine being in a relatively small, enclosed, acoustically reflective area with that much noise. No, don't. If you haven't done it, you can't imagine. The sound was less like noise than it was like being thrown into an enormous vat of petroleum jelly. Instantly, I felt like there was no way to get a good breath. There was pressure against all of my skin and pain in my ears, like when you dive to the bottom of a deep pool. I dropped my staff to the ground so that I could clap my hands over my ears, not that it did much good. This loud was a full-body, weapons-grade loud. It was a minor miracle I had the presence of mind to hang on to the bucket. I had planned to run for the truck, but I hadn't really counted on how damn loud this spell was going to be. So I staggered that way instead, barely able to keep my feet and walk in a straight line. The corner hounds had it worse than I did. Under the assault of my dino serenade, they crouched in pure agony, tendrils flailing, head tentacles flapping wildly, like some kind of flared hood lizard receiving jolts of current. They weren't howling now, or if they were, it was kind of redundant. Sometimes the best defense is a T-Rex. I drunkenly fell only twice on the way to the truck. Then came the hard part. I had to take my hands off my ears, and the music felt like it was going to burst my eardrums. I put the bucket down, crouched beside the truck, and called upon winter. Being the winter night isn't much fun. Having that mantle in my life on a daily basis meant that I had to fight and work every day to keep being more or less me. The damn thing made me think things I would rather not think, and want things I would rather not want. Being the winter knight doesn't help you be a good dad or make better pancakes. It doesn't help you understand philosophy, create beauty, or garner knowledge. What it does do is make you hell on wheels in a fight. I seized the truck by its frame, used the hem of my spell-armored leather duster to protect my hands, tensed my back and legs, and stood up. It was hard. It hurt like hell as the edges of the frame and the mass behind them bit at my hands, even through the duster. My muscles screamed in protest, but the absolute cold of winter ice filled my thoughts and my limbs, a counter-agony that either dulled the physical pain or gave me so much additional pain that the mere physical torment seemed irrelevant by comparison. The pickup truck quivered and creaked in my hands, and with a surge of my shoulders and legs, I got my grip reversed and pushed the vehicle up onto its side. Staggering under the assault of the ongoing dino serenade, I clenched my right hand into a fist and peered at the truck until I found the plastic of the gas tank. Then I drove my fist into it and right through the tank's wall. I ripped my fist out and brought the bucket up with the other hand at the same time. Gasoline flooded onto my shirt and then into the bucket. 5 gallons fills up pretty damn quick from a fist-sized hole. Once it was sloshing over the brim, I turned and staggered back toward the circle. And my dino serenade ended. The silence hit me like a club. I staggered to a knee, barely able to hold onto the bucket, and gasped. As I did, I became aware of the corner hounds. Most of them were gathered around Ebenezer, who was protected by so many layers of energy that his actual bodily shape was distorted to my sight. But one of the hideous creatures wasn't 3 feet to my left. Another was less than 6 inches to my right. There was a stunned, frozen instant where none of us moved, and the world was one big aftertone from a chime the size of a skyscraper. And then my own sadly unremarkable singing voice added into the silence at the spell's finale. And many more! Tendrils flailed in excitement. Tentacles flared in angry aggression. I broke into a sprint, sloshing gasoline from my bucket. Sir! I screamed. A corner hound leapt at me, 1,000 pounds of tentacles and talons and muscle. I ducked, reflexes as sharp and fast as the report of a gunshot on a clear winter evening. Claws raked at my back. The duster's protective spells held, and all the night's sweat and discomfort became worthwhile. Ebenezer, meanwhile, had survived the blast of infrasound that the pack had begun to deliver just before my spell went off, and he hadn't wasted his time since. With a single word, he pointed at the concrete floor of the parking garage, and a cloud of fine chips of rubble flew upward in a perfect circle as the old man's will dug a trench 2 inches deep and 4 across in the obdurate flooring. 3 of the hounds hit him, 1 second motionless, the next moving like serpents guided by some singular, terrible will. The old man swatted one of them away with an upward blow of his staff, and a detonation of kinetic energy that slammed the outsider into the concrete ceiling and brought it back down in a shower of rubble from the impact. The second hit him square in the chest with outstretched talons, and there was a humming snap of expanding energy that sounded like a bug zapper the size of a Tesla coil. It recoiled from the old man, claws burned black. But the third corner hound hit him in one leg, and while the old man's shield protected him from the impact, the natural consequences of Newton's first law and having one leg slammed out abruptly from beneath him were harder on the old man. He went down with a gasp as another trio of corner hounds blurred to within striking range at the base of the column. The outsiders closed on my grandfather, talons and tentacles tearing. Flashes of light, humming howls of electricity, the stench of charred flesh, and basso moans filled the air as the old man fought them. His body encased in armor of pure will that made my own defensive spells seem crude and primitive by comparison. I sprinted to help him, and as I did, I felt the plummeting tone of a subsonic roar hit my back, a sensation weirdly like that of a low-pressure stream of water. One second I was moving fine, the next I was staggering, the entire garage a sudden blur. My guts had turned to water, my knees to jelly. It was everything I could do to get a hand on the ground and shift to a modified 3-point gait in order to keep from simply falling over and spilling the bucket and its contents everywhere. As I moved forward, the ground kept rotating counterclockwise, no matter how much my rational brain insisted it couldn't be happening. My inner ears weren't having it. Behind me, the hounds came forward in sudden streaks of oily speed. I gullumed across the lower end of the circle the old man had cut in the floor around him, with hounds in full pursuit, and two more flying toward me from the circle's upper end. They were already in mid-leap. From the floor, from beneath the mound of foes, the old man shouted, and a burst of wind suddenly swept up from the floor. It caught the two hounds with exactly enough force to lift them over my head and past me, sending them crashing into the pack pursuing me, briefly disrupting their advance. And the old man did that from under a pile of 9 more of the things, trying to seize him with their tentacles and tear him into quarters. That is a wizard, people. I covered the rest of the ground toward the uphill end of Ebenezer's circle. I couldn't have dropped the gas into the circle at its lower end. Gravity wouldn't have been our friend. But I got to the uphill side of the circle and poured out the gasoline as quickly as I could without sloshing it out of the little trench in the concrete. One of the quarter hounds let out an ululating cry, a sound distressed, and half the creatures atop Ebenezer peeled off him and flung themselves at me. The corner hounds probably should have thought their way through taking pressure off a man of my grandfather's skills. A shouted word sent a burst of flame roaring out from the surface of his body in an expanding Ebenezer-shaped wave of blue-white fire, and the corner hounds around him recoiled. The old man slammed his right palm on the earth, growling a low phrase, and gravity suddenly increased around the hounds coming toward me, dragging them to earth as they fought in vain against the weight of their own bodies. The hounds on Ebenezer recovered from the blast of flame and threw themselves onto him again. Now he couldn't fight back. Not and hold the hounds coming toward me, anyway. The outsiders went at him, and there was another light show as the old man's personal defenses resisted and spat sparks of defiance back at them. In that moment, only the power of my grandfather's mind and will stood between him and death. Meanwhile, the four who'd originally been on me came darting spastically back into the fray, circling out around the field of increased gravity that held their companions. I looked up to see the corner hounds blurring toward my face, which was exactly where I did not want them, but I flung my face into the circle because that was where I absolutely did want them, spinning as I went so that I could look back and see the corner hounds leaping toward me in a group so tight that each of the four hounds was touching the others. Talons and tentacles outstretched in one of those moments that, at the time, seemed to last forever. And as I went, as their tails cleared the line of the circle, I focused my will on the trough in the floor, snapped my fingers, and shouted, "Flick-em-bickus!" My will carried fire to the gasoline in the circle, a single small static spark of eye-searing brightness. And flame leapt up with a low sound like something huge taking a deep breath. The fire racing swiftly around the circle's exterior and burning with a clear, cold blue light. Working magic inside of circles is intense. Doing it in a ring of fire, where the flames close the circle, is like being inside a room where the walls and floors and ceilings are all sheets of mirror, with infinities of reflection spinning in every direction. Anything you do with magic inside a ring of fire has the tendency to build power very, very rapidly, and to send fragments of energy rebounding around inside of it, recombining in potent and unpredictable ways. So potent and unpredictable, in fact, that while the technique was not black magic per se, It was nonetheless on the list of prescribed spells and actions that the wardens used to assess the warlock potential of any given wizard. It was that dangerous. Think of a ring of fire as, oh, an experimental fusion reactor. One way or another, something big is going to happen. If this banishing got out of hand, something closely resembling a small nuke could go off in the middle of the Gold Coast. The good news was that this was the kind of magic I was good at, moving massive amounts of energy in a straight line. Even better, the fact that the outsiders were in the circle with me meant that I didn't need any of their bits to create a channel for the spell. Of course, it also meant they could rip my face off while I tried. God, I love working under pressure. I hit the ground and slid a ways as the first of the hounds closed on me. I kicked its squishy nest of tentacles as hard as I could with one booted heel along the way. That pushed me back a bit from the thing and seemed to disorient it long enough for me to shout, "Hounds of the Corners, I banish thee!" I infused my voice with my will, and the normally invisible screen of the circle suddenly came to green-gold life, myriad ribbons of tiny flame stretching up to the ceiling of the garage. But rather than remain a steady column, the ring of fire pulsed and swelled and subsided again. Flickers and sparks began to spit from the stone where Ebenezer's will held gravity against four of the hounds. More sparks began whirling off his defensive spells, larger and brighter, moving more like fireflies, with an eerie emulation of biological purpose. When I added my voice to that, the flames brightened to an almost unbearable intensity, and a basso wail went up from the 13 throats at once, and every single hound turned to fling itself at me. Once the old man was loose of them, he promptly raised his left hand and smacked his palm down on the concrete, and concrete groaned as gravity increased again, dragging at the hounds, who, despite their resistance, were crushed inexorably to the floor. And the old man's face had gone purple with the effort of the spell, his expression twisted into an agonized rictus. My God, he could be killing himself right in front of my eyes. He couldn't keep up an effort like this for long. "Corner hounds, servants of the outer night, this world is not meant for you," I shouted at them. "I banish thee." Again came a chorus of basso moans, but the helpless hounds couldn't break the grasp of Ebenezer McCoy's will. Except for one, the one who happened to be nearest me. The old man, while holding his defenses and an earth magic working that would take me at least a minute to even assemble, had done a second earth spell with such precision that he had excluded me from the excessive gravity while catching all the corner hounds in his mind's net. Well, 12 out of 13. The last one began to drag itself out of the gravity well and toward me, pushing itself upright the moment its front talons cleared the increased gravity, its legs bunching for a leap that would end at my throat. It got clear and leapt. The ring of fire began to make a howling sound, the light flickering and strobing through several spectrums of color that fire had no business emitting. The energy in the air became so thick that it made my eyes itch, and I hadn't even added my own gathered will to it yet. If I defended myself from the hound, abandoned the banishing, there would be no way to predict what would happen with all this gathered energy. So I stood my ground, as the hound tore free of the heavy gravity and shouted, "Hounds of Tyndalos, return to the void that awaits thee! I banish thee!" I raised my staff in both hands and began to release my will. And I felt them inside my head, felt the outside. I'm not going to try to explain to you what it was like to experience that. If it hasn't happened to you, there's no common point of reference. It hurt. That much I can tell you. The winter mantle didn't do a damn thing against that kind of pain. Pain is as good a way to think of it as any. Touching their thoughts to yours is like licking frozen iron and giving yourself an ice cream headache from it at the same time. Their thoughts, or whatever madness it was that passed for them, began to devour mine. I felt like my mind was being chewed apart by a swarm of ants. And then, just for an instant, the alien thought patterns made sense. And I saw an image from their point of view, a being made of coherent light, a column of glowing energy centers, and pure dread, standing like an obelisk before the corner hounds. A bolt of terrible lightning gathered around its upraised fists, head, and shoulders like a miniature storm front. I saw what they saw when they looked at me, and I felt their fear. The winter mantle howled with sudden hunger. Winter's power flooded into me, and frost gathered on every surface in the park and garage with a crackling like a swimming pool full of pop rocks. Certainty flooded over me, the sense of the fusion of purpose, will, desire, and belief. Certainty that moments like this were precisely why I existed in the first place. Be gone! I roared and slammed my staff down, unleashing my will as I did. And within the ring of fire, reality became a storm of ghostly energy, of random light and sound, of darting bolts of light and color. I felt the corner hounds raise their will against mine, and theirs crumbled like day-old cornbread. I tore them from their ectoplasmic bodies and sent their unseen, immaterial asses screaming back to the void outside of all creation. The 13th hound's talons were maybe 8 inches from the tip of my nose when energy howled and swirled in a circle as the banishing spell caught up the corner hounds. There was a sudden indrawn breath sound that moaned through the night all around us, a great shuddering in the air, and then they simply vanished. So instead of being dismembered by a 1,000-pound monster, 1,000 pounds of gross, slimy ectoplasm smashed into my chest, promptly knocking me on my ass and sending me sliding 15 feet across the floor. 12 more corner hounds' worth of ectoplasm washed out over the now extinguished ring of fire and began to ooze over the entire parking garage. Ebenezer sagged down to lie on his side, then rolled onto his back, breathing as heavily as if he'd been running upstairs, while a sludgy flow of ectoplasm 3 or 4 inches deep went past him. It looked like the after-party on the set of The Blob. I tried to flick goo from my fingers and had little luck. The stuff was like snot, but stickier. And if not for the fact that it would sublimate and vanish within about a quarter of an hour, it would have put a real dent in my wardrobe over the years. But for the moment, I was covered in clear, gelatinous snot. We were both silent for a moment before Ebenezer croaked.
See? Not one vampire needed.
I eyed the old man, weary from the expenditure of so much energy. Then I asked, Why do you hate them so much, sir? He glanced over at me and stared for a moment, pensive. Then he asked me, Why did you hate those ghouls you killed at Camp Kaboom? I frowned and looked away. I wasn't proud of what I'd done that day, but I wasn't sure I'd do it any differently either. The things those ghouls had done to a couple of kids I'd been helping to teach did not bear thinking upon. Neither did the ghouls' endings. I used ants. The old man sighed. When I looked back at him, his eyes were closed. His cheeks seemed sunken. And there was a sense of desperate weariness to him that I had never seen before. When he spoke, he didn't open his eyes. See, you know why. I hate them because I know them. Because they took someone from me. Mom? I asked. His jaw muscles tightened. Her too. What you did to the Reds was a hell of a thing, Hoss. But the part of me that knows them thinks it was only a good beginning. God help me. Some days, I'm not sure I don't agree. The Red Court got the way they were by killing a human being, every one of them. The White Court is different. They're born that way, And they're not all the same, I said.
Game they've played for a very long time, Hoss, he said. You'll see it for yourself, if you live long enough. He exhaled and sat up. Then he reclaimed his staff and shoved himself to his feet. His face didn't look right. It wasn't purple, at least, but it was too pale. His lips, maybe, a little gray. His eyes belonged on a starving man. It's best if we get off the street and behind some wards, he said. If they've got the gumption and resources, whoever sent those things might try it again. No, I said. Not until I get something on this whole Starborn thing. His jaw flexed a couple of times. Then he said, I told you. You were born at the right time and place. As a result, you... He sighed as if struggling to find an explanation. Your life force resonates at a frequency that is the mirror opposite and cancellation of the outsiders. They can't take away your free will. They're vulnerable to your power. Hell, you can punch them and they'll actually feel pain from it. Well, a kick to the sort of face had made that cornerhound flinch for 3/4 of a second, anyway. Let's call that one Plan B. Good idea, Ebenezer said. I frowned. This Starborn thing, it happens all the time? The old man seemed to think about that one before he answered. Once every 666 years. Why? I asked him. What's it for? What's coming? The old man shook his head. Lesson's over for tonight. I already said more than I should have. Wait a minute, I said. Hoss, he said, his voice quiet and like granite. There's nothing you can do for the vampire except go down with him. Drop it. He closed his eyes and spoke through clenched teeth. Or I'll make you drop it. I expected to feel fury at his words. I don't react well to authoritarian gestures. But I didn't feel angry. Just hurt. You don't trust my judgment, I said quietly. Course I do, he said grumpily. But I care about you even more. And you're ears deep in alligators, and you ain't thinking so straight right now. He pushed back a glob of ectoplasm that threatened to gloop down into his eyes. You know me. I don't want to do this to you, Hoss. Don't make me. I thought about what I was going to say for a moment. I had always known Ebenezer McCoy as a gruff, abrasive, tough, fearless, and unfailingly kind human being, even before I knew he was my grandfather. I wanted to tell him about his other grandson, but I understood the hate he felt. I understood it because I felt it myself. It was the kind of hate not many people in the First World are ever forced to feel. The hate that comes from blood and death. From having those near you hurt and killed. That was old school hate. Weapons grade, primal. If someone somehow revealed to me that a ghoul was actually my offspring, I wasn't sure how I'd react, beyond knowing that it wouldn't be reasonable and that fire was going to come into it somewhere. I couldn't count on my grandfather. I might be all my brother had going for him. Sir, I said finally, you know me. When someone I care about is in trouble, I'll go through whatever it takes to help them. My next words came out in a whisper. Don't make me go through you, sir. He narrowed his eyes for a long moment. You figure you can, Hoss. So far, so good, said the man falling past the 30th floor. We both stood there for a moment, dripping ectoplasm, neither one of us moving. Stars and stones, the old man sighed finally. Go cool off. Think it over. Sleep on it. His voice hardened. Maybe you'll change your mind. Maybe one of us will. One of them, he spat the last word, as if it had been made of acid, is not worth making an orphan of your daughter. It's not about who they are, I said quietly.
It's about who I am and the example I'm setting. The old man stared at me for a moment, his expression unreadable. Then he turned and stalked away, slowly, his shoulders slumped, his jaw clenched. As he went, he vanished behind a veil that was, like most of his magic, better than anything I could do. Then I was standing there alone in an empty parking garage. I looked around at the wreckage and closed my eyes. Family complicates everything. Damn it. Chapter 13.
Hounds of Tyndalos are real, huh? Butters asked. Weird.
Well, for some values of real, I said. Lovecraft got kicked out of the Venatorium Brawl Room for mucking about with Thule Society research. Don't know many of the details, but apparently it wasn't actually cancer that ate his guts out later. It was something more literal. I sat at the little table in Butters' apartment kitchen. I had my duster off and both hands resting on the table with my palms up. Butters sat across from me, wearing loose exercise clothes. An EMT's toolbox sat on the table next to him, and he was currently peering at my hands through his thick glasses, which he now wore in the form of securely fastened athletic goggles. Butters was a little guy in his early 40s, even littler since he'd gotten in shape. Now he was all made of wire, maybe 5'5", but if he weighed more than 140 pounds, I'd eat my duster without salt. His hair was a dark, curly, unkempt mess, but that might have been a factor of my showing up at his door after hours. God, Butters muttered, using a wipe to try to clean up the deep, gashing cuts on my hands. You've got motor oil in the gashes. That a problem? He gave me a sleepy, unamused look. Considering all the debris it collects, yes, yes it is, he sighed. Gotta debride it. Sorry, man. I nodded. Just get it over with. After that, it was about 20 minutes of water, betadine solution, and a stiff bristled brush being applied to the area around and inside the wound. Could have been worse. Butters could have used iodine. Could have been worse, but it wasn't exactly a picnic either. Hands are sensitive. 20 minutes later, I was sweating and grumpy, and Butters was glowering at the injuries with dissatisfaction. That's the best I can do here. I'll wrap them up, but you'll need to change the bandages every day and watch like hell for any sign of infection. But in the ounce of prevention department, until you get invulnerable skin, buy gloves to protect your hands, Hulk. Not a bad idea, I said. How bad is the damage? I have this issue with feeling pain. It's part of the winter night package. When something happens to me, I sort of notice it, but ongoing pain just fades into my background. So bad things can happen to me without my knowing it, if I don't use my head. I don't think there's damage to the actual working structure of your hands, Butters said. But the human body isn't really made for flipping trucks, man. You're developed to something like the maximum potential for your height and build, but your joints are still human joints. Your cartilage is still only cartilage. And even though your body will actually heal damage to it, it has a failure point. And your bones are still just made of bone. He shook his head. Seriously, one of these days you're going to try to lift something too heavy, and even if your muscles can handle it, your bones and joints won't. What's that going to look like? I wondered aloud. An industrial accident, Butters said. He wiped down my hands one more time, thoroughly, then began wrapping the injuries. Okay, so the White Council wants to give you a hard time. What else is new? Butters was not up on the concept of the Black Council, a covert group of wizards who were nebulous and impossible to identify with absolute certainty, working toward goals that seemed nefarious at best. That information was being held under wraps by the wizards dedicated to fighting them, partly because we had little evidence about the Black Council, what they wanted, and who their numbers were, and partly because the bad guys would have more trouble taking action against us if they couldn't even be sure who was their enemy. Butters was trustworthy, but the Black Council was a wizard problem.
Yeah, I said, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Butters gave me a look, because I'm not a very good spy, and lying to a friend doesn't come naturally to me. But he shrugged and let it pass.
Okay, he yawned. When you called, you said something about health issues, plural. What else is bothering you?
I told him about my sneezes and conjuritis. He narrowed his eyes and he said,
this isn't some kind of prank you're playing on the new guy in the game, is it? Because I've sort of been expecting that.
What? No, that's crazy talk, I said, and tried hard not to think about my dino serenade due for his birthday.
This is a real problem, man.
Sure, Butters said, snapping his rubber gloves off and beginning to clean up.
Whatever.
Of all the crazy things to happen in my life, I wouldn't think that my randomly involuntarily conjuring objects out of nothing at the drop of a hat would really ping anyone's radar.
All the things happening right now, and this is the point that Butters picks to decide to stonewall me on?
I sneezed again, hard.
There was an enormous crash as a section of mortared stone wall, maybe 4 feet square, landed on Butters' kitchen floor so hard that the tables and chairs jumped off the floor.
Butters yelped and fell over backwards out of his chair, into a backwards roll that brought him onto his feet, right next to the steak knife holder on the counter. He had his hand on the knife before I could get all the way to my feet.
Little guy, but fast. Knights of the sword aren't ever to be underestimated.
There,
I said, swiping awkwardly at my nose with my forearms.
There, do you see now?
Butters just stared at the stone wall. Then he quivered when it shuddered, went transparent, and then collapsed into gallons and gallons of ectoplasm. The supernatural gelatin kind of spread out slowly over the floor like a test shot for the remake of The Blob.
Okay, Butters said. So, that just happened.
He regarded the ectoplasm and then me and shook his head.
Your life, Harry. What the hell?
Don't ask me, I said. I sloshed across the kitchen floor, got a paper towel, and started trying to blow my nose clean. It was kind of a mess. It took several paper towels worth of expelled ectoplasm to be able to breathe properly again. Look, I can't be randomly making things appear out of nowhere.
I'm a medical examiner, Butters wailed. Christ, Harry. Some kind of virus that has an interaction with your nervous system or your brain or your freaking subconscious? This is something to take to the Mayo or John Hopkins or maybe Professor Xavier's school.
None of those guys are weird enough. You do weird. He put his knife back and threw up his hands.
Oh. Okay, is there always a sneeze?
Yeah, so far, I said.
Then go get whatever cold medicine you use when you have a cold. Maybe if you stop the sneezing, you'll stop the conjuring, too.
I eyed him blearily and then said, betrayed, I could have worked that out for myself.
Weird, he said. It's almost as if you're a grown damn man who could make some common sense health decisions for himself if he chose to.
I flipped him a casual bird, idly noting the pain of my wounded hand as I did.
What about the nausea? I feel like I'm stuck on one of those rides where you go in circles. Infrasound is pretty wild and unexplored stuff, Butters said. There's too many potential weapon and military communication applications for it, and it's hard to measure, so there hasn't been a ton of publicly available research. But the Paranet being the Paranet, I found some Bigfoot researchers who say that the Bigfoot use it all the time to encourage people to leave the area. Tigers and other large predators use it, too, as part of the roar. You know, when you hear stories about people freezing when a tiger roars? That's infrasound, having an effect on the parasympathetic nervous system.
Thank you for confirming that infrasound is real and has real effects on people, I said. But I sort of worked that one out for myself. How do we fix it?
According to the Bigfoot guys, mostly what it takes to recover is a solid sleep cycle. So if you're going to insist on treating me like your personal physician here, Take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. I grimaced. Yeah, sleep probably isn't an option either.
Of course not,
Butters sighed. He went to a cabinet, got a plastic bottle out, and tossed it to me. Allergy meds? I asked skeptically.
Are you a doctor now?
Butters went to the sink and filled up a cup of water. Maybe I'm only a medical examiner. Butters dipped a finger in the water and flicked it at me, then sloshed carefully through the slime and put the cup down on the table in front of me.
Diphenhydramine, he said. Sneezing is usually a histamine reaction. This is an antihistamine. Should help. Take 2.
I did as I was told, without uttering any intelligible complaints,
thus proving that I am not a contrary obstreperous stiff neck who resents any authority figure telling him what to do.
I mean, it's documented now, so that's settled. I heard a soft sound and looked up at the doorway to the kitchen as a young woman appeared in it. Andy had long, wavy red hair and bombshell curves. She wore an emerald green terry cloth robe, which she held closed with one hand. Her eyes were sleepy, and she was possibly the most adorable werewolf I knew.
Waldo, what was that bang? What happened to the floor? Oh, Harry.
She gathered the robe closed a little more closely and belted it.
I didn't realize you were here.
Andy, I said. Sorry, didn't mean to wake you up. She gave me a tired smile.
Word is, things are getting tense out there.
Word's right, I said. Be a good idea for you to get as much sleep as possible in case you're needed.
And yet, Butters protested, here you are waking me up, I notice.
For you, sleep time was yesterday, I said. You're needed now. There were soft footsteps and a second female voice said,
Is everything okay?
Another young woman appeared, built slim but strong, legs like a long-distance runner's beneath an Avengers t-shirt big enough to serve her as a dress. She had very fine mousy brown hair to her shoulders, and she was squinting her large brown eyes against her lack of glasses, her narrow face disrupted by sleep marks on one cheek.
Oh, she said. My goodness. Hello, Harry. I'm sleeping over after the LAN party. Oh, did you hurt your hands?
Marcy, I said, to possibly the second cutest werewolf I knew.
Hello. Yeah, just having old Doc Butters take a look and make sure I didn't void the warranty.
Oh, Marcy said. Oh, I see.
There followed a long, awkward silence in which Butters turned a sufficient shade of pink to advertise for breast cancer awareness, and in which Marcy looked at everything in the apartment except me.
Oh, for God's sake, Andy said. He's an adult human being, guys, and I'm tired. Draw conclusions, Harry. He won't be far off, and I'm not cleaning this mess up.
She turned, took Marcy's hand, and walked firmly back toward the bedroom. Marcy's cheeks flushed bright red, but she went with Andy. I looked at Butters, whose earlobes could have been mistaken for tamales, and arched an eyebrow. The little guy took a deep breath. Then he said, in a calm and sincere tone,
Harry, tease me about this, or screw it up for me, and I'll knock your teeth out.
And he said it right. I mean, there's a way to convey your sincere willingness to commit violence. Most people seem to think it involves a lot of screaming and waving your arms. It doesn't. Really dangerous people don't feel a need to shout about it. Delivering that kind of warning sincerely takes mostly the sort of confidence that only comes from experience. Butters had only had the sword since the end of winter. He'd only been doing full-speed night work for about a month, but I'd seen him square off against maybe the scariest and most dangerous bad guy I personally knew, and Butters won. And here he was, facing off with me, like a grouchy badger. He told me to back off and made me want to do it. Damn, little guy had gotten all grown up on me. I lifted my hands, palms out, in a gesture of peace and said, Okay,
but I reserve the right to talk to you about it later.
Oh, God, can we not? Butters said.
He went to rummage in the fridge, restless and uncomfortable as a schoolboy caught with adult magazines.
We're sort of keeping this low-key.
Low-key, huh?
Look, he said plaintively, I'm honestly not quite sure how this happened, and I'm not going to let anyone screw it up.
Butters, I said. I waited until he turned to look at me. Then I said, you're not sitting in my kitchen asking for my help, man. I'm pretty sure you can make the choices for your own damn life, and there's too much glass in my house to throw stones at anyone. His eyes searched my expression for a moment before some of the tension went out of him.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Sorry, man.
Nothing to be sorry for, I said. I glanced back toward where the women had disappeared to and opened my mouth. Then I ran my tongue thoughtfully over my teeth and closed it. Honestly, it's really kind of startling how many problems that avoids. I should think about doing it more often.
Well, Butters said, in the tone of a man getting back to business. The Paranet has sent out advance warning. Everyone's been told to see something, say something. How about some details?
I nodded and let him know what was up with the Accorded Nations and their peace talks and what had happened to Thomas. He listened, his expression growing increasingly concerned.
That sounds, like it could get interesting.
Something in his tone made me look up at him.
Oh? Sonya's in town, Butters explained. Hotel by the airport. He was just transferring through O'Hare, but his flight got delayed 7 times.
There were currently 2 knights operating in the whole world, 2 of them, and the Knights of the Sword, or Cross, depending on how you looked at their professional priorities, tended to wind up wherever they were needed most, always by pure coincidence. In fact, the coincidence was so freaking pure that it basically told me that it wasn't. I have a dubious relationship with God, but judging from the timing of the entrances of the knights he sponsored, he would have made one hell of a travel agent.
Ah, I said.
Maybe Sonya could visit for a couple of days. You guys could swap some nightly stories or something. Butters gave me a tight smile.
Right. How do I help you? I shook my head.
I've learned by now that you guys are gonna show up exactly where the Almighty wants you, and I'm probably smart not to bump anyone's elbow. So it's up to you. How do you think you'll do the most good? He regarded me for a moment, then he said quietly,
it's the Paranet crowd I'm worried about.
Magical talent is like the rest of it. Not everybody gets the same amount. There are people like me who can sling around the forces of the universe as if they were their personal play toys. And then there are folks who, while gifted, just can't do that much. The have-nots of the magical world had an unenviable position in life, aware of the world of the paranormal, but without sufficient personal power to affect it. Until the Paranet, anyway. Use of the internet had done something for the have-nots that nothing else had before. It had united them. Meeting people, making friends, coordinating activities had all become more possible to do in relative safety. And it had created something just as powerful as tremendous inborn magical talent, a community. Supernatural predators were having less and less luck against the have-nots these days as they coordinated actions, communicated with one another about possible threats, and joined their individually unimpressive talents into coordinated efforts that made them, in some senses, damn near as strong as a wizard themselves. But though they had gathered enough strength to keep the vermin at bay, they still couldn't stand against a storm like the one that was brewing.
Agree, I said quietly. And they know you, trust you. Work with them. Get all the intelligence you can and coordinate it with Murphy. What about Thomas?
Butters didn't know Thomas was my brother,
but he knew he was an ally we'd fought beside on too many occasions to consider leaving him behind.
What I'm working on, I said. Could be that a diplomatic solution is the best one.
Butters slipped on the slime and nearly fell on his ass. He caught the countertop and held himself up instead. Then he stared at me, fighting back a smile, and said, "Who are you, and what have you done with Harry Dresden?" I glowered at him and rose, careful to keep my balance amid the ectoplasm on the floor. It was already sublimating. Maybe half of it was gone. I shrugged back into my duster.
I don't prefer to blow things up and burn things down. It just sort of works out that way.
Butters nodded. What's your next move?
Diplomacy, I said. With the vampire queen.
You're not going out to the chateau alone, are you?
Chateau Wraith was White Court headquarters in these parts.
Yeah, Butters sighed. I'll get my bag.
No need, I told him. Mab and Lara have a deal going, and Mab's made it clear what Lara is and is not allowed to do. She'll play nice.
Butters frowned. You sure?
I nodded. Rest up. Might need you for real in the next few days. He looked from me toward the bedroom, his conscience at war with the rest of him.
Okay, he said finally. Good luck, Harry.
I only have one kind of luck. I nodded my thanks to Butters, grabbed my staff, and set out to visit Lara Wraith.
Chapter 14.
The Wraith Estates are about an hour north of town, out in the countryside, where the nearest neighbor is too far away to hear you scream. The place is surrounded by a forest of old enormous trees, mostly oak, that look like they were transplanted from Sherwood Forest. Hell, given how much money and power the White Court had, maybe they had been. I pulled up to the gates of the estate in the Munstermobile to find them guarded by half a dozen men in full tactical gear and body armor. They weren't kidding around. As I stopped the car, five men pointed assault rifles at me, and one approached the car. His spine was rigid, his shoulders square, his manner relaxed. Lara recruited her personal security almost exclusively from former military, mostly Marines. The man who approached my car had a solid blend of the lean athleticism of youth and the weather-beaten edges of experience. He wasn't even bothering with a friendly smile. I'd run into him before. His name was Riley.
Can I help you, sir?
Those look like ARs, I said. I squinted at the guns pointing at me. But with real big barrels. Beowulfs? Riley shrugged.
Can I help you?
I'm to see Miss Wraith, I said. The grounds are closed for the night. I looked at him and rested my arm on the window, leaning back comfortably in my seat. Lara didn't hire chumps, so I was dealing with a professional. Most of the time, when something like this happened, I tended to react adversely. But I was here to talk about a diplomatic solution. I was kind of new to this, but it seemed to me like blowing things up and knocking Lara's people ass over tea kettle probably wouldn't be an auspicious beginning. And besides, I was willing to bet the other five or six guys I couldn't see right now would have a rocket launcher or something, and I didn't need to add getting blown up to the list of my problems. So I smiled at the guard and said, "Look, you and I crossed trails over the Luther case. Didn't turn out so good for your boss, but you kept it from being a real wreck, and we were both good to our word." Riley eyed me and grunted acknowledgement. "I'm here to help," I said. "Call a house. You won't regret it." He stared down at me for a second. Then he walked to the guardhouse and got on a phone while several extremely heavy-duty guns, known for their vehicle-stopping capability, pointed steadily at my noggin. His face turned a little paler than it had been, and he waved at the other guards, causing them to lower the weapons and get out of the way. He pointed at me, and then at the gate, and the gate buzzed and began to swing open. Before I could put the car into gear and pull in, a Humvee pulled out of the dark inside the fence. The military-style truck was painted all black and had an actual Ma-Deuce machine gun on a pintle mount atop it. The Humvee preceded me, and as my car began to roll, a second truck, mounted with a second machine gun, pulled in behind me. Riley swung up onto the running board of the second vehicle, his rifle held up and ready with one hand as we began to move forward. I was, it seemed, to have an escort up to the house. We all drove.